Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Squawker Talker Women's Football Podcast. Now, we had a busy weekend of women's football action and we're going to be focusing mainly on the Champions League semi-finals. But before we get there, I'm one of your hosts, Harry Edwards, and I'm joined as always by Mariam Naz. Yeah, and let's go straight into it. We'll start with Chelsea's trip to Bayern Munich. It wasn't the result Chelsea wanted. Bayern took the lead through Sidney Lohmann, but Melanie Leupolz equalised. And then in the second half, Hannah Glass won it with, you know, you'd have to say a good long-range effort. But as we predicted in last week's pods, Bayern caused Chelsea a lot of problems with their crossing.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, we mentioned it a lot. We talked about Brennan and Glass. We talked about those aspects and we talked about how much of a weakness it had been for Chelsea early on in the season. But I think the more interesting thing was that alongside that, Bayern were looking to target Chelsea centrally. And they knew that it was going to be a problem because the whole situation of Millie Bright working next to Sophie Ingle. And it's something that Millie Bright really struggles with when she's working alongside Magda Eriksson. You can tell how confident she is in her play and how especially where she is of her position. And I think that says more really about Eriksson than it does about Millie Bright. But working alongside Sophie Ingle has been a struggle for her. And we saw in the build-up of both goals an approach from Bayern to go through centrally and target that. They were tactical. They knew exactly where Chelsea's weaknesses were. And last week we talked about this and we kind of said we thought Chelsea would get the edge over it. But it seems like it's the other way around. Bayern had done their homework and it was pretty much a bit of a masterclass.
Yeah, Bayern definitely countered Chelsea's weaknesses more than Chelsea countered Bayern's. And I think it, looking at the way they lined up, Bayern went with three at the back, which I don't think many people expected. And that really restricted Chelsea's attack. But I do just want to quickly go back to what you said about the central defence, and I completely agree. I know in the past we've spoken about how good Millie Bright is, but she looks, you know, below her usual standard when she hasn't got Leupolz behind her. And I think, you know, I think we're both big fans of Sophie Ingle, but I think in these games she's it doesn't help having her alongside Jonna Andersson, because Andersson does push up. And I think it was Karen Carney in the build up to the game said that another benefit of having Eriksson alongside Andersson, which I didn't really think about, is that where they're both Swedish, they can communicate a lot easier than Ingle and Andersson might be able to, you know, quickly. So Eriksson can bring Andersson in and keep her where she needs to be. I think we saw that in the second half when I believe Hayes switched Bright and Ingle around because Ingle just wasn't coping with covering Andersson. Back to the attack. I think, you know, Chelsea were quite, you know, fortunate to score. Leupolz's goal was, you know, no one really knew anything about it. And apart from that, Chelsea were really, really nullified. I'd say only Sam Kerr maybe was the bright spark. I don't think Frank Kirby was at her best, but I think that's because Bayern did so well. And then in the second half, I believe she had to drop deeper. So she was playing deeper to defend. But I think, you know, this just wasn't a good Chelsea performance. And, you know, we're just naming all the positions, but the midfield was quite weak for Chelsea again.
Yeah, and just to go back to that point you mentioned about the attack, it was quite nullified. I do think, though, that Chelsea were at their best from an attacking perspective when they were moving things quickly. Because Bayern are a counter-attacking team. We saw how well they were doing that when they kind of literally played straight through the heart of Chelsea defence. But Chelsea were actually having a few chances. There was that chance from Gura Wright and that shot that went over. The nice little flick to G. Those were the moments that Chelsea kind of didn't finish, but they were making chances when they were playing quick attacking football. As you mentioned, Bayern knew how to stifle that a lot in the attack, and both the goals that came, that were, you know, the cross through from Glass and then the, again, long range shot, I think both of those involved a quick attacking play from Bayern, and they were able to use their flanks a lot. And actually in the first goal, we mentioned Millie Bright before, it was actually her blocking really Ann-Kathrine Berger. She was right there in the middle and things got a bit confusing. I think again that says a lot about how she plays when Eriksson isn't there. But in the second goal, there was so much space for Glass, and I think that's something that Emma Hayes will not be happy about. It's something that you know, the press that's normally quite persistent with Chelsea because they are a high-press team and they are actually one of the first teams who brought it about in the WSL. That press was non-existent, and you can only imagine what Emma Hayes is thinking about her team and how difficult they found it to play like that.
Yeah, and especially, like you said, on that second goal, I know some might look to the fact that it came from a throw-in for Chelsea, that the lines that the assistant referee gave that was overturned. And I think you could hear Emma Hayes wasn't happy because it maybe felt that Bayern got the decision changed because they protested loudly. But Chelsea just didn't recover quickly enough from that. And it was from that move that Bayern broke. And Chelsea the defenders might have felt that they had the situation covered because they weren't letting Glass get into the box. But they also didn't, like you said, there was no pressing. They didn't close her down. They gave her the option to shoot, and it was a really, you know, it was a good shot. We can point fingers, I think, at Berger for the first goal. And I know, obviously, like you said, it wasn't a good goal all around. But I think this one, it was a bit of, you know, a bit of class that beat Berger. I don't really want to go around in circles, but again, like you said about the shots, Chelsea did have more shots than Bayern, but they only had one on target. Like you said, it was Wrighton just went over. I think Pernille Harder had a shot that just missed. G hit the crossbar in the second half. Bayern weren't able to completely restrict Chelsea. But it was, you know, I don't mean to disrespect Bayern by saying this, but they out Chelsea. You know, there are times where in the past where Chelsea haven't been in control of the game and in periods, but they take their chances, and that's exactly what Bayern did. And Chelsea improved, I think, later on with some of the changes that Hayes made. They took the risks, and it could have come back to bite them. But I don't know, what do you think Chelsea need to do differently next week in the second leg to, you know, keep their chances of progressing?
I think one thing I really want to mention is that both the Atletico game, second leg, and both the second leg and Wolfsburg, we've learned that every single time there are mistakes made in the first leg, Emma Hayes works on that and she notices it and she identifies that. And that's something I thought she really struggled with early on this season. Chelsea were having bad performances, but she was still sticking with the same tactic, the same players that were causing those bad performances. But in both these recent Champions League games, she's learned, and she's learned how to fight those sides. In the first game against Atletico Madrid, the midfield really struggled a lot, and they struggled in the flank areas. And obviously there was that sending off. In the second leg, they were quite tight to not allow Madrid to get that fast start. The first game against Wolfsburg was quite difficult. Like we mentioned Engen and how she got the run in the midfield. Second leg, you know, that wasn't as prominent. The first leg here, obviously, has the main point is about the lack of press and how easy it was for Bayern to counter-attack. I think one thing that Emma Hayes could think about is adding, changing the midfield and perhaps formation for 3-4-3 and adding in some ball carriers who can really up Chelsea's possession stats. Because I don't know myself what it was, this percentage, but I do know that the way that Bayern were driving through the Chelsea midfield, that's something that Chelsea themselves were lacking. They weren't able to, you know, out Bayern the way that Bayern were out Chelsea. So I think that's one thing she's going to want to think about, to add a bit more sort of protection in that area. I'm thinking maybe Aaron Cuthbert, or even having like a difference in terms of whether she's going to implement that double pivot. But there definitely needs to be more protection. As you mentioned, the issue of John Anderson and Sophie Ingle and that doubling up, that's been a problem as well. So I think there needs to be more intensity about Chelsea's play. They know they're playing a counter-attacking team. They're playing a team that they need to press quite consistently. So I think there's loads of different elements that Emma Hayes will be thinking about. And I'm actually quite confident that there will be changes because, as you mentioned, that's what happened in previous Champions League fixtures. So you can hope that we see that change and we see a better performance.
Yeah, and like you said, I think especially in the Wolfsburg tie, you saw the difference that the changes made in the result. Against Atletico Madrid, Chelsea were happy to stay compact because, you know, they had control, they had the 2-0 lead. But Wolfsburg, they used their changes to blow Wolfsburg away and do to Wolfsburg what, unfortunately, they are going to be at risk of Bayern doing to them next week, because, like you said, Bayern are a good attacking side, and Chelsea need to go and attack. I think they'll be hoping that hoping that Magnus Eriksson is back. I think with a week off now, you know, that gives her another week to hopefully recover for Chelsea. And then if she can come back into the defence, I think they Hayes might push Ingle forward to that double pivot, like you said, with Leupolz, because on Sunday it was more of a midfield three. But when you've got Leupolz alongside Ji-Seo-Yong and Guro Wrighton, you know, those two are players that are, you know, they're happy to do the defensive work for the team, but they're not defensive players, so they are going to want to push further forward. So they are going to get caught out. And I think, again, like Aaron Cuthbert, like Hugh said, is someone that adds to that fight in the midfield as well. So in an ideal world, I think she'll probably stick with the back four, apart from switching Ingle and Eriksson if she can. So I think Jonna Andersson and Jess Carter will still play. I think she'll keep Jonna Andersson and Jess Carter as the fullbacks. I did actually see some suggestions online about maybe switching to a back three herself, but I don't think Chelsea have the centre-back personnel to do that. I don't think you want Ingle as part of the back three. I think you want her in the midfield role to help Leupolz protect. And you know, Chelsea have got to take risks. They won't feel that it's over. When these sides last met in the Champions League, Chelsea went through on away goals after losing 2-1 away, although that was in the second leg, and a 1-0 win at King's Meadow, which is all they need. You know, so like you said, it's not over, but I do think Chelsea need to be a lot better prepared. And as Hayes said, you know, it's got to be the performance of their lives next week. So I only really have one question for you. Do you, you know, to get the predictions out early, do you think, you know, do you think Chelsea can do it, or are Bayern reaching the final?
I think last time we did this, last week, I think I said 2-1 to Chelsea, and obviously that hasn't happened. But I am more hopeful of a better result away from home. I know the only thing that kind of concerns me, obviously, is that we need to keep Bayern from scoring, and I don't know how we'll do that. As you mentioned, hopefully the return of Magnus Eriksson will help. Hopefully Emma Hayes has learned that actually we do need that double pivot with Leupolz and G, because that's going to really strengthen the centre of our structure. So I'm hoping those two changes are made and that results in a better performance overall, and hopefully we can hit them on the counter just as much as they were hitting us. So it's a really difficult one. You just got to hope, I think, as a Chelsea fan, that, you know, we see another Fran Kirby masterclass or a Sam Kerr backflip and something goes well, but it's going to be an incredibly difficult game.
Yeah, I think, like you, it's very hard to call. Well, whoever does get through will take on one of PSG or Barcelona, and their tie is fairly evenly poised at 1-1, though Barca have the slight advantage with the away goal. In last week's episode, we predicted Oshuala would be the danger person for Barcelona. She didn't start. Yeni Hermoso started through the middle, and it was her who opened the scoring. Alana Cook equalised for PSG not too long after. You know, it was a really even and exciting game with, you know, so much talent on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we were seeing both sides show their strengths. I think Barcelona were finding a lot of space centrally and also in the gaps. I think PSG were using their crosses a lot. That opening goal for Barcelona, however, exposed their weakness, which was, the issues in the central defence they're having at the moment. I think they were playing a back three, but I'm pretty sure one of their main players, who they normally play in defence, was missing or absent from the injury. So that cross that came in, and, you know, as you mentioned, Ayem also got the shot in. PSG really were exposing that element. But then it was another header at the other end. So I think both sides were showing their strength with the crosses. So two headers in the game, you knew straight away that it, you know, that element of it was going to be the sort of the main way to score.
Yeah, and again with the crosses, I think last week we spoke about Hayes saying that Anne Katrin Berger and Christian Endler were, you know, the two best goalkeepers in the world. And like Berger against Bayern, Endler didn't have, you know, the greatest of roles in Barcelona's goal. You'd expect someone of her quality to do better with the positioning, but she more than made up for it with some frankly unreal saves later on in the game. I think it was, you know, it felt like a usual PSG in a big game where, you know, they had so many good chances. You know, they had fewer shots than Barcelona, but their chances felt better, but they couldn't put them away. And we saw it in the first leg of the quarterfinal against Lyon, where, you know, up against a big team, they didn't, you know, they could have got a better result than they did. They, you know, they got there in the second leg. But I think, yeah, I think this was, yeah, it was just a really good game. And, you know, the answer to my question, you know, what happens when a team that concedes just 5 goals faces a team that scored 145 is, you know, apparently it's a 1-1 draw.
Yeah, I think I would have expected more goals. I was actually just thinking that as you were speaking. You would have expected more goals based on that situation, only because we know how talented Barcelona are. But I think that PSG did quite well to nullify them in the beginning of the game. And I think Barca had to switch up to their flank play because they knew that would be a weakness for PSG. So I think that slight tweak and adaptation shows quite a good performance. But as you mentioned, Barcelona do have the advantage going into the second leg. And you can imagine that trying to stop them from scoring and then also PSG having to score themselves, I think that's going to be quite difficult for PSG. And if you combine that with their track record in big games, as you mentioned, that there's a psychological element too. I do think that Barcelona are going to get the edge here, unless we see some kind of masterclass as they did against Lyon. We see a shock result like that.
Yeah, I think mentality is definitely not a problem for PSG, but a barrier that has beaten them in the past. And it'll be interesting to see how much of beating Lyon in the quarterfinals, how much inspiration they take from that going into this second leg, because, you know, like Chelsea, they do need to attack. They are in a better position than Chelsea are against Bayern Munich, although they both just need one goal. But PSG, you know, I think Barcelona can kind of sit back and happy knowing that PSG do need to take it to them. And, you know, like we all speak about Barcelona's goals, but their defence is also, you know, pretty solid as well. You know, Man City did do well against them in the second leg of their quarterfinal, but I think, you know, Barcelona knew that the game was already, the tie was already won, so they set off a bit. So again, I think I'm going to ask, you know, who do you think goes through? Who do you think, know, takes advantage of that second leg?
Well, I think we've already seen, as you mentioned, we discussed Oshawala, but she didn't even start. So you kind of think about whether or not that will be a feature in the second leg. I think that PSG will know that they're going to have to double up against her Mercer, because when she's in the box and she's unmarked, as she was kind of for that, for her goal against PSG, that's when they're in trouble. She has so much aerial prowess and threat, as well as other aspects of her game. It's so difficult. So they might just think about switching to a man-marking style and doubling up against her. In terms of their own attack, though, which they also have to focus on, I think that, as they found, free kicks and corners seem to be the way to take it apart. Barcelona, that goal that they scored, and it did involve a flick on, and I think that there was a lot of confusion in the box. Barcelona didn't exactly know where the ball was going, so I think PSG need to find ways to literally sort of cause that confusion and that miscommunication and the dissonance that was there during that goal. And I think that if there is a way to get through that, then that's how they're going to score their goals. But they also obviously have to think about how they're going to nullify Barcelona's attack, because, as you mentioned, 145 goals between them. It's just an insane number, and you don't really expect a game where they won't score. So it's going to, again, it's just like the Bayern-Chelsea game. It's going to be so difficult to call. But I suppose we're at that stage of the Champions League. Everything is difficult to call. The people who win this are going to the pinnacle of it, which is the final itself.
Yeah, I think it's part of the fun of Lyon being out of the competition is that we've got 4 teams left who, you know, all are very equal in levels this season. And, you know, you can make a case for any one of the 4 winning the Champions League, but you can also make a case for any one of the 4 not winning the Champions League. You know, there are, or, you know, losing in the final because there's another team that has the strengths in any of the matchups. I think personally, if I was going to put, you know, my neck on the line with a prediction for this one, I think I'd see Barcelona just getting the edge, just because they have the comfort knowing that, you know, if they keep a clean sheet next Sunday, you know, they're through to the final, and it is something that they have done before, and you know, it's taken them a while to get over some previous heartbreak. But I think, you know, they're the more complete teams out of these two, but not to take anything away from PSG.
Yeah, no, I do agree. I think that, you know, PSG have done wonderful, and I think that a lot of teams will be thanking them for what they did against Lyon. I know that sounds a bit weird, but I think that it's helped a lot of teams kind of get to a better stage, and also just the idea that there's going to be a different winner this tournament, that's great, and I think they've done great to come so far. But you do just see Barcelona on a different level, not just in the Champions League, but domestically also running away with the league. You know, as we mentioned, the insane amount of goals they scored this season, I think that that's going to be hard to contain. And I think that in the other game, that's probably the more interesting one, because you don't know how to call it. You don't know whether Chelsea are going to switch up and they're going to just be a completely different beast to play against, and they've learned a lot of things from the first game, or whether there's going to be a goal in there for Bayern and then it's just going to be too much to overcome.
Yeah, and obviously the Bayern game is a big roadblock for Chelsea in their potential quest for a quadruple, one of which, you know, they are still in pole position in the Super League, and there was, you know, action in the Super League this weekend, although Chelsea and Man City weren't involved because they played last week, because Chelsea were playing in the Champions League this week. There was still, you know, a lot of excitement at both ends of the table. Probably the most key result of the weekend came in Aston Villa's 2-2 draw with Bristol City, the two teams at the bottom of the table. You know, Villa took a 2-0 lead and it looked to be done, but Brighton fought back and with one of the last kicks of the game equalised. They're still level on points, but Villa are above on goal difference and do have a game in hand, which is against West Ham coming up. Who, you know, I personally think it's going to be between one of those two that goes down. Who do you think gets relegated? Or, you know, one of those two, or, you know, can someone else still be dragged in?
I think that that game between Villa and West Ham is going to be a big one, because we've seen a few games for West Ham in the last few weeks or so where they've completely switched things up. You've got like four or five goals from them, or you've got a hat-trick from one of their players. And I think that that's going to be quite difficult, probably more difficult than people would have thought. You know, we pretty much think that West Ham are safe, but can Aston Villa really get a point even from that game? That's going to be a difficult one. And I think they don't. If they lose that game, then it's pretty much kind of sealed their fate.
Yeah, it's that is a really big game. It's quite, I think it's good the way that the fixture list has panned out, that, you know, we've still got mathematically five teams that can still go down with, you know, only a couple of games left in the season. You can probably count Tottenham safe, because Bristol City aren't going to get 5 points. They aren't going to get 6 points from their final two games. But still, West Ham, Birmingham City, Aston Villa and Bristol City are all, you know, just 2 points between them. And Birmingham have to play Aston Villa as well. They've got Aston Villa this coming Wednesday. I think, for me, Bristol City celebrated their draw against Aston Villa, because it does keep them still in it. But, you know, I'm going to be, you know, the joy kill here for them. I, you know, I can't see them getting any points from their last two games. You know, they've got Man United and Brighton, and I think less so the points, but it's more the goal difference that might be the killer for them. Because even if Aston Villa do lose their three remaining games, they've got to, you know, have a big goal difference swing. And, you know, Man United still have something to play for. And they showed against Tottenham on Sunday, that, you know, they are still very much in the fight for the Champions League.
Yeah, and I think sort of both for Arsenal and Man United not having other concerns at the moment, like with the Champions League, I think that's really helped Joe Montemiro's team have had a turn in form. They were really struggling for a while, but the return of Jordan Nobbs and you know, there are certain players that have come back into form, like Ford and Maud. I think that's really helped them out. You kind of just have to think, though, a bit about Casey Stoney's team and whether they have the chance to do that, because they did lose quite recently. And we've seen them struggle this season against teams who have a pretty high press. So I'm just wondering whether or not it's going to be Arsenal who get that spur of form and just push through for the Champions League spot, and whether that kind of leaves Man United with a bit of a bitter taste in their mouth.
Yeah, you know, I think that's exactly what I'm, you know, was going to ask. You know, given where Man United were even around January, February, do we think them not qualifying for the Champions League should count as a failure for them and for Casey Stoney this season because of where they were, or can we still just look at it as they were never meant to be there in the first place? It's okay that they did eventually drop down out of the top three.
I feel like the last few seasons they've started seasons pretty strongly, and the dip in form has come later on, even though they've not had any other sort of obligations or responsibilities with other, I mean, I suppose Conte Cup, FA Cup, those things are natural. But I just wonder whether or not the summer introductions they made, like, you know, the American players that came over, I just kind of sort of think about how Emma Hayes is thinking about restructuring a team. We saw Emma Hayes do it this season with Chelsea. She brought in many loopholes. They changed from, you know, an all-out attack to a more possession-style base of football. I wonder if we're going to see that for Man United. I feel like they don't have to consider this season as a failure. You know, there are mistakes and things they need to pick up, but I wonder whether we're going to see a restructure for Casey Stoney, and whether, because I definitely think there's a step up that they're missing, and I wonder how they'll find that. Is that a restructure? Is that bringing in players from different teams? Is that shifting formation? Because, you know, they're just on the outskirts of reaching that top level that Chelsea and Man City are at, I think, and Arsenal even. I think they're not there yet, so I wonder how Casey Stoney is thinking about levelling up.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think it's, like you said, it probably will be a bitter pill to swallow. But again, I don't think it should be a failure, because if you look at, instead look at the ground that they have caught up from last season, I know there were fewer games last season because it didn't finish, but they were 13 points behind Arsenal in third at the time of the curtailment last season. And now, you know, they're going into the final few games potentially level or as many as just 3 points behind Arsenal. So they've plugged that gap. And I think if I were a Man United fan, I'd look at the season as a whole rather than in sections, because like you said, they did start well. And I think the drops probably looks more dramatic in a season where there are only, you know, 22 games played rather than, you know, the 38 plus that you see in the men's game. So a drop might be more gradual, even one as, you know, that isn't as dramatic as first to outside of the Champions League spots. I think like you said, this should just be viewed as, know, maybe step two on their quest to Champions League football, you know, the first being that they, you know, got into the WSL in the first place. You know, they made signings last summer that started to build the team to become, you know, WSL regulars, and it is all about what they do this summer. Can they, you know, can they keep the, you know, Tobin Heath and Christian Press, can they keep them tied to United for, you know, a little longer without the promise of Champions League football for next season? You'd assume that they, you know, they didn't offer that promise at the start of the season, because I don't think even in their wildest, you know, imaginations they thought that they'd be this close, just because of how established the top three are. So yeah, I think, you know, if you are a Man United fan, just, you know, you can be realistic about what's happened, but don't, you know, don't be too harsh on Casey Stoney and the team, because they've done so well from where they started to get to where they are now.
Absolutely.
You know, I think, you know, we've covered pretty much all the, you know, the exciting topics of the weekend. Thanks once again for listening, all of you. We'll be back next week to round up the second legs of the Champions League semi-final and prepare for the final round of WSL games, which is on the, just a quick maths in my head, the 9th of May, I believe, is when the WSL season finishes, and there's still a lot to come till then. Thanks.